Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now we turn to Nepal and the recovery from the earthquake on Saturday. There was at least some good news yesterday when two people were rescued in Kathmandu, but the death toll keeps climbing, and there's destruction of so much of that city and the infrastructure throughout Nepal since that earthquake. We'll hear from two guests in the next segment, BBC reporter Sanjoy Majumdar and Chris Skopek, who is Senior Director of Emergency Response and Preparedness for the International Medical Corps. And we want to hear from you, Nepalis in the listening area, New Yorkers with connections to Nepal. What are you hearing from the people you love in Nepal this week? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Also tell us about any fundraising events happening in the area this weekend, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. But I want to start with Sanjoy Majumdar in Kathmandu now. Sanjoy, you have been there since the earthquake on Saturday?
Just shortly after we got in the following morning, as soon as the airport was open to civilian flights. So about 12 hours after the earthquake struck.
And what is the situation like right now?
Well, the situation is that in Kathmandu, which is where I am, which is the capital, much of the city is slowly limping back to normal. There are many parts of the city still devastated, but there's a strong effort to try and clear up some of the rubble. Yesterday, of course, we had an incredible situation where within the space of a few hours, two people were pulled out from the rubble, a teenage tour guide who'd been buried under a five-story building which had collapsed on him, and he managed to survive by staying inside an air pocket. And a few hours later, very close to where he was, a 22-year-old woman was also pulled out alive. Incredibly, both had spent more than 120 hours under the debris. The woman is the teenage boy is doing really well. The woman, however, has quite a few. You know, she was severely dehydrated. She's still in hospital. All the doctors are confident that she will survive. But that apart, it's more of a clear-up operation in the city itself. Out in the countryside, though, close to the mountains and the villages close to the epicenter, the situation is much, much worse. Many people still to receive help of any kind, and of course, entire villages which have been destroyed.
The death toll is over 6,000 right now. Any sense of how many people are homeless at this point in Nepal?
We've heard varying degrees of information, but the government has said that close to 500,000 people are displaced, so have basically nowhere to live. Some of these, of course, are people who are too frightened to go back indoors, even if their houses are fairly intact, because of the severity of the earthquake, but also the aftershocks we've experienced since then. And there have been some every single day, including earlier this morning, when we could sort of feel, I was sleeping and I could feel the bed shake and the windows rattle. And that's made a lot of people very nervous of going back indoors. So that's the figure we know, basically living outside.
I saw one of your reports from earlier this week, and you talked to a line of volunteers who were moving rubble by passing bricks one by one between each other. This was not an operation with heavy machinery. This was people using their bare hands and passing bricks to one another. Is that what moving rubble looks like in Kathmandu right now?
Well, that was a fairly specific instance because I was in a historic part of the city. It's called Darbar Square. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And the square has been very badly damaged. There are a number of temples there dating to the early 19th century, which have been very badly destroyed. And so the piles of rubble there include sort of, wooden carvings from the temples, but also a lot of brick. What the volunteers were doing were trying to carefully remove each brick and store them so that they could use in the rebuilding process. And it really tells you a lot about how people here viewed this part of the city. It's a very significant part of their heritage. Many people I spoke to were absolutely distraught at seeing it destroyed. And this was their way of trying to ensure they could preserve it. They weren't just people from the armed forces and the police who were there. There were a lot of local residents, as were a lot of tourists. I met people from France and from other countries who were holidaying in Nepal. And all they said was, they just wanted to do something. And this was a great way, they thought to help.
And is it your sense, it's been nearly a week since the earthquake in Nepal, does it feel like the recovery effort has gone into sort of full gear, and do you feel encouraged by the response, or does it feel like there's still a lot of capacity that needs to be filled by aid organizations or the government?
Well, first of all, this is a very poor country, and it's always going to need significant amounts of help, not just in terms of money and material, but also expertise, because it simply doesn't have enough of that to deal with the situation. Having said that, I think there are two different things. I mean, in the cities such as Kathmandu and a few others, things have sort of kicked into place. I think the problem is in the remote villages up in the mountains, where, as you say, nearly a week after the earthquake, many people continue to go without proper food, water, or have adequate shelters. And that's leading to a build-up of frustration. There's a lot of aid that's coming in. I mean, there are plane loads of aid being flown in every single day, everything from, you know, bottles, from, you know, water to tents to medical supplies, field hospitals, just about everything's coming in, as are entire teams. I mean, I met today in Kathmandu teams from, you know, there was a French rescue team which specialized in looking for people. There was a medical team from China. The problem is the way the relief effort's been organized has been very ad hoc, and that's really where the government is getting very strong criticism for its inability to manage this properly. A lot of aid workers I spoke to said, you know, they were sort of wasting their time in Kathmandu when they should be up in the mountains helping villages, but they couldn't do that because they didn't quite know how to go about it.
How are aid workers reaching these remote villages?
Well, in some places, of course, they have managed to get through with the help of the government. In other places, they've decided to just head out on their own after waiting for days in the capital and without any means of going ahead. So they've somehow managed to get there on their own. One of the big problems is that Nepal, and this is something the government's openly admitted, simply doesn't have the infrastructure it needs. It, for instance, has only 20 helicopters at its disposal. Many of these communities up in the mountains can only be reached from the air because the road connection has been broken. So the Nepalese government has now asked international governments to try and send more helicopters. We know China's sending some, Britain's sending three Chinook helicopters later over the weekend, but it clearly needs a lot more than that. The other thing they're saying is that even in places where they can reach by road, they simply don't have enough vehicles to carry the aid forward, trucks, for instance, to carry supplies through. They're trying to ask, you know, they rent vehicles from private owners without much success. So these are problems that the country has, and that's one reason why nothing is getting through to, or not enough is getting through.
And even before the earthquake, so much of Nepal's economy depended on remittances, which is money Nepalis were earning abroad and sending back home. And there's been the suggestion that Nepalis who are working abroad will come home to help their families rebuild and perhaps collapse that source of revenue for that are so important to so many Nepalis. What are you noticing about the movement of Nepalis after the earthquake?
Well, the most significant movement I've noticed is people getting out of Kathmandu as fast as they can. I mean, over this week, it's amazing, but there are estimates that 300,000 people have left, you know, left the city. You know, that's about a quarter of the city's population. Many of them were heading out to the villages from where they came, some to get away, some to see in case they felt in the earthquake zone, see if they were still standing. There were others who were going overland to India. So the sense you got was a lot of people were getting away. There are, of course, some people coming in, but I think it'll be a while before you see that happening, quite simply because it's not an easy place to get to in the first place. There aren't enough flights coming in. The airport is heavily choked because of the number of relief flights. It's taking a long time for people to come in. But you're right. I mean, Nepal's economy is very dependent on the money that overseas Nepalese send back home. It's really the bulk of their economy, and that's something they're going to have to depend on, as well as assistance from the international community. Already today, the finance minister said he thinks he's going to need $2 billion to rebuild the entire country, or at least parts of the country that's been hit.
$2 billion. That's Sanjoy Majumdar, a BBC reporter who's been in Kathmandu since just after the earthquake. Thank you so much for joining us while you're doing this important reporting.
Thank you.
And I want to bring in Chris Skopek, who's the Senior Director of Emergency Response and Preparedness for the International Medical Corps. Chris, who do you have on the ground in Nepal right now?
We have a robust team, actually, at this point, but it's taken us a while to get there. We've got 30 international colleagues, including medical doctors and nurses, but they've been able to also harness a lot of local capacity, medical professionals, as well as others, to mobilize this response. We were fortunate in that we had three of our core first responders in country, coincidentally, in a tourist capacity on vacation there. So we were able to mobilize response quickly. But those first couple days deploying our teams in, we had a number of planes turned back, other flights were canceled, and really the only people we were able to get in was by land through India. But that's changed since, and the flights have been resumed. We have been able to get staff as well as cargo in, but as our BBC colleague said, it's an incredibly congested airport and continues to present a lot of logistical challenges for us.
We are taking your calls for Nepalis in New York with connections back home or New Yorkers with connections in Nepal. Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. This is WNYC FM, HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. Ashok in the Bronx, have you been in touch with people in Nepal?
Hello.
Hello, yes. Welcome to WNYC. Have you been in touch with people in Nepal since the earthquake?
Yes, constantly. I've been in touch with people in Nepal as well as community, a large community in New York area.
And what are you hearing from people you're in communication with? Are they in Kathmandu?
Kathmandu as well as outside of Kathmandu. Basically, the situation there is getting increasingly worrisome because especially those who live outside of Kathmandu, they haven't had enough support, and the response has been extremely slow, although the international community's response now is beginning to trickle in. So that seems a bit encouraging, but I think what they call the golden, you know, window of saving people, I think that's rapidly, you know, decreasing. So that's very sad.
And you're from Nepal?
I'm from Nepal, and I currently teach at the new school. I'm director of India-China Institute, and I'm quite involved now in working with a number of organizations in New York to both educate as well as to engage with Nepal.
And how is your family back home?
Fortunately, my parents who live in Kathmandu, they are safe. But several of my friends have lost their homes and also their family members, which is very, very sad.
Ashok, is there any organizing happening in New York City that you want to let our listeners know about to support Nepalis?
Yes, there are a number of, you know, good organizations working and mobilizing people. I'm involved, personally involved, at the new school through an organization called Gurung Society of USA. There's a concert, international concert, that's taking place on May 16th. If people go to India-China Institute at the new school website, they can find information on that. And also, there's a very good organization in Queens called Adhikar, A-D-H-I-K-A-R, that does good work and that's raising funds. So I would encourage all the listeners to really generously contribute at this very, very difficult time in Nepal. And Nepali community here has done the same, you know, whether it's a disaster related to Sandy or Haiti. So we're hoping that, you know, as part of global community, all the, you know, WNYC listeners who are very progressive and very thoughtful will really reach out and come to support people of Nepal.
Ashok, thank you so much for your call.
Chris, thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Of course, of course. Chris, Ashok just mentioned there the closing of the golden window where you move from a rescue effort to trying to collect bodies. What are the people that you're working with? What sorts of injuries are they treating right now?
Well, we're looking primarily at crush injuries. The intense surgical period is also coming to a close, but there's still a number of people with basic injuries that need to be treated that haven't had any medical care. As everybody has noted, the biggest challenge is getting out to the remote communities who haven't been able to access any services. There has been a great outpouring of support from the international community, very notably from the Nepali diaspora themselves, and there's a good number of medical, both foreign and domestic, teams on the ground. But getting to the places outside of Kathmandu, the most affected areas, continues to be a huge challenge. And we're looking really at every option on the table, from paragliders, to horses and donkeys, and just old-fashioned hiking for hours and in some cases days and weeks to get to some of these communities.
Of course, with any natural disaster, there is often a collapse of infrastructure, and it's difficult to reach places that are remote. Does Nepal feel like it has a particular challenge in reaching these communities?
Absolutely. The infrastructure was not strong to begin with, and just the outlay of the country being as mountainous as it is, with so many remote populations, has made this a unique response in many ways.
And where are the hospitals? Where are these patients going who were injured?
Kathmandu has a number of hospitals that are still very operational. Just because of the ongoing aftershocks, many of the patients are being treated outside, so it creates some very intense images of a number of patients lined up outside. But they are operational, and there is a backlog of patients, but they're addressing them as they speak. There's been, as I said, a tremendous amount of support in that area. And in other urban areas, in Gorkha and in Dading, closer to the epicenter of the earthquake, the hospitals are still operational, but they do need additional supplies and support. And again, getting people that need that level of care to the hospitals is extremely difficult.
Have you been able to get as many medical aid workers into the country as you'd like to get into the country?
At this point, yes. As I said, the first couple days were difficult, but we have since been able to get the number of medical professionals that we need, and there's been not just our organization, but a number of other countries and organizations have brought them in. At this point, the request is to stand down the deployment of other foreign medical teams because we feel like we've reached a saturation point. However, it's utilizing those teams that are on the ground and coordinating their work that is the biggest challenge, and getting them out again to the communities that need it, so that we're not all just concentrated in Kathmandu, is what we're faced with today.
Chris, can you walk us through the next week, the next 2 weeks, the next few months? What will happen to Nepalis who've been severely injured, crushed, have orthopedic problems, but who survive? Where will they be while they recover?
Well, it's going to be difficult. The infrastructure and the facilities right now don't have the rehabilitation capacity that's going to be needed on the scale that it's needed. So there's already a huge request for rehabilitation services and supplies, things like wheelchairs and crutches and canes. But in addition to that, there's very much a public health concern with the lack of good drinking water available in a country where cholera is endemic. The chance for outbreaks is significant at this point, so we have to put in strong surveillance systems to ensure that communicable disease doesn't get spread. We've got to make clean water available and promote good hygiene. So these are some of the follow-ons to a disaster like this that can create additional casualties that we need to mitigate against.
And another question about this particular disaster and how it compares to others that you have responded to. What's your feeling about the interaction and coordination with the central government? Does it feel like NGOs are taking a more prominent role because of the relatively weak central government in Nepal?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, we're all in this together. It really is for the government to lead. The United Nations has established a strong presence in country. Coordination is always one of the toughest things in the immediate wake of a disaster on this scale. So it's never fluid. It's never as good as we want it to be. But we are all in this together. We have, as an international community, as much responsibility as the government does, and we're here to support them in that process. And it's important to remember that nobody that lived through that earthquake is unaffected. The government is staffed by people, and these are people that lost their family members, and they lost their homes, and they lost their livelihoods. So everybody's affected in this, and we really need to come in and ensure that we're supporting them in leading the effort to respond.
Chris Skopek is the Senior Director for Emergency Response and Preparedness for the International Medical Corps. Chris, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.